Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we want to start out this program today, again, wishing you all a happy, happy holiday season.
We have a special greeting for young Adam Ezra Haig.
Oh, yes.
Because it's his birthday today, and we're not going to tell anybody how many, Adam. Don't worry, we won't let on. But we certainly hope you'll have a wonderful day and enjoy spending it with your delightful wife, Jen, and your two beautiful children, and all your friends at church and everyone else you might have the opportunity to share it with.
Yeah, and so you know, Adam is, we didn't give the number of years he has.
No.
But he has one more Christmas than he has years because of being born on the 23rd.
There you go.
Well, it's like your sister Pat's being on the 24th.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, let's back to the business of the day. Today we're dealing with some fundamentals for those of you who are not certain that you have the grounding you should have in learning to cook at home or learn to be a chef for that matter. We've got four great new books, which each of which is a great authority on the particular subject they're covering, and we'll introduce them to you one at a time. But first up, who do we have first up, dear?
Oh, yes, this is a great book. Martha Holmberg wrote Modern Sauces, and again,
that's all you need to know. Just listen up.
Good job, Martha Holmberg. This is quite an accomplishment, this book of more than 150 recipes for every cook every day called Modern Sauces.
And the amazing thing is it had a gestation period shorter than an elephant.
Yes.
So you must have worked really hard.
Well, but you've been around sauces for a long time. I mean, you studied with Ann Willen at La Varenne in France. You're an editor of Fine Cooking and publisher. You were food editor for Oregonian newspaper. So you are a Oregonian now, although you hadn't been forever. And you've written other books. So it's not like it was all new to you, but the organization is rather amazing.
Thank you. I have been eating, cooking, and enjoying sauce for a long time. And as you say, I think my kind of fascination and understanding of them did come when I was studying cooking in France, and then I stayed there for several years and, of course, ate delicious food and worked with French chefs at the cooking school. So that's kind of where my technical understanding of what's happening in a sauce came down. But then over the years, you know, my food style has expanded way beyond just classic French cooking, and I've gained lots of new insights into different techniques and also just an appetite for other types of sauces. And I wanted to find a way to just pull those all together into one central place.
Yeah, I guess sauces become a teeny bit of a dirty word. People think of that classic French heavy on cream stuff, right?
Yeah, I think there are two misperceptions about sauces, and they really are the reason that I decided to write this book now. One is that sauces are heavy, rich, oh my gosh, that's indulgent, or just something you don't really want to eat, like a bechamel sauce, white cream sauce. But also people think sauces are hard. They just imagine like, oh, you have trays of veal bones that you have to roast, and then you have to do things with them, and then you have to skim things. And we all know that that's not true. There are so many fabulous sauces that can be made in seconds or minutes or definitely the amount of time we have.
You broaden the definition of sauce, though, in this book. How would you define what is a sauce?
Yeah, and the definition of a sauce was something I struggled with in the beginning because I had to set parameters and I had to really figure out what do I mean by that. And so for me, it's really, what does this thing do to the dish? It's not whether you pour it or you spoon it or you dollop it. It's the way it interacts with the other ingredients in the dish. And for me, a sauce is the thing that makes the dish. It's the thing that pulls it all together. So you might have a piece of meat and some vegetables and something else that are all independent entities on the plate, but when you put a sauce with them, all of a sudden it becomes orchestration. Everything better, more interesting. Not to get too sort of metaphysical about it, but a sauce in a way as the energy source or the catalyst for this.
Oh, I love that phrasing. You did that in your introduction. I just thought it was beautiful phrasing. You can tell you're like an engine of deliciousness. A well-made sauce brings energy to a dish. I just love that sentence. It jumped off the page at me.
This was a fun book to write because I really did have to sit back and think, well, what do I think about this technique, or what do I think about, why do I do things a certain way, and what do I think is happening? So as I tried to share all that with the reader so that they would have success with the recipes, it really was fun for me to reflect on what my cooking technique is all about.
Now, where did the modern part come in?
Modern part comes from, I wanted to build a collection of sauces that are the kinds of sauces that we like to cook and eat today. And it wasn't so much on whether you used an old-fashioned ricer or a new whatever. It's not about modern equipment nor ingredients, although there are some ingredients in there like smoked paprika that you might not have seen 10 or 15 years ago. But for me, modern is it something that I want to eat? Is it exciting and vibrant? Does it fit the way we eat today? And is it something that where the time and effort is worth the payoff?
Everybody
has time constraints, and I would spend 10 hours a day cooking if I could, but I can't. So I want to make sure what I'm doing is worth the effort, whether it's a 5-minute sauce or a 2-hour sauce.
You have, if I don't count, your first chapter, which I think is an important chapter called Sauce Essentials, where you talk about things like clean prep versus dirty prep and things like that. I thought that was wonderful. You really identify 14 categories. Let's look at some of them. Vinaigrette's obvious. Herb sauces. What distinguishes an herb sauce? You have pesto in there. I thought that was surprising.
Yeah, the herb sauces, it was interesting to come up with the categories because some are technique. The technique is similar for all the dishes, and others, they are united by perhaps the main ingredient. So the herb sauces is a sauce where mostly what you've got in there are fresh herbs as opposed to mostly oil and vinegar, you know, in an herb vinaigrette. So I have pestos, but I also have things like cherry sauce, which is that Argentinian full of lots of fresh parsley and cilantro and garlic and all those zesty. And I have one that I love, which is a charmoula. It's similar to a pesto, but you don't have the cheese. It's a little looser, and it has a lot of acid from lemon juice as well.
And it's a classic sauce. When you run through in each of these chapters the definition and the technique tips and then the recipes, you then turn it all around and offer recipes for using the sauces, which I think is very valuable.
Well, yes, I didn't want to leave people hanging with, okay, I've made a great sauce, now what do I do with it? And I also wanted to show people some perhaps slightly surprising places that they could use their sauce or help open their eyes to different ways to enjoy a sauce. I think everyone knows you could make a vinaigrette and put it on a salad, but I've got vinaigrette on fish, and I love it on a pork chop and on mashed potatoes or dried beans. So I'm just really trying to show people that you can be really creative with this. You can be very versatile. You can go all kinds of ways and bring those sauces into all parts of your cooking.
See, I'd love to make this sauce vierge with the roasted cauliflower tonight because I have a huge cauliflower, but I don't have all these ingredients.
You can improvise a little bit.
What would I substitute for basil?
Well, you could just use parsley. You could use a little dill, could be fun. Anything, I think, of among those tender herbs, the ones that aren't too resinous like rosemary or thyme, I think all those tender herbs are kind of swappable.
Oregano. I could do that.
Yeah, that's a little stronger, so I'd cut back on the quantity, perhaps.
Okay, then you move into tomato sauces, which maybe people don't think of as a sauce. Actually, if you're Italian, you think of it as Sunday gravy. Then you have another one that was surprising, vegetable chili and nuts.
Yes, there are a lot of wonderful additions to your food, sauces, that can be made really simply by making a puree or a coulis of tasty ingredients. And in some cases in that chapter there, the main ingredient is something highly flavored, like the enchilada sauce, which you take dried chilies and rehydrate them a little bit and then puree them and make a beautiful enchilada sauce, which you can use on other things. And in other cases, I had really a lot of fun because I've taken a fairly bland ingredient like the potato and garlic and olive oil sauce, vaguely modeled off of a scordalia, Greek sauce. And in that case, the potato is just this wonderful creamy textural background for the livelier flavors of the olive oil and the garlic and the lemon juice. And as I was making it, I realized kind of like potato mayonnaise, and the potato is the oil as opposed to in the mayonnaise when it's the oil. So, yeah, those are sauces, and a lot of those sauces are quite healthful. They don't have a lot of high-fat ingredients, or if they do, wonderful olive oil.
Now, you mentioned just how a Greek sauce. I wouldn't have thought of a sauce with potatoes. and the other ingredients you mentioned, and you said, but it's like a Greek sauce, which
it
I'd never even heard of it in my ignorance. But my question is different than that. Are there any sauces you actually invented?
Well, depends on how you define invent. I'd say in the butter sauce chapter, there are quite a few sauces that I haven't seen elsewhere. The technique I didn't invent, where you have flavorful liquid, you reduce it down till it's this wonderful little syrup of flavor, and then you whisk in butter to emulsify and to extend the sauce. So that's the technique that has been used for hundreds of years.
Right.
And then, for example, the one that I love that I invented is apple cider that you reduce.
Oh, I was just looking at that.
Oh, good, yeah. And I have a little hot ingredient in there, a little bit of chili to balance the sweetness of the apple, and then whisk in butter. And that's a beautiful sort of sweet, tart, hot balance. It's great on fall vegetables. So has that been done by someone else in the world? Probably, but it basically came out of my head for this book.
Yes, for your purpose, you invented it. It's not like bechamel sauce or hollandaise or one of the traditional ones that
Correct.
I guess you learned for the first time in France, but along the same concept, producing this pleasing flavor that acts as a catalyst for what you put it on.
That's correct, and I think that goes back again to the modern aspect, because a lot of the techniques and the inspiration for the recipe do come out of the canon of classic dishes, but the way I'm interpreting them and the ingredients I'm using to pull them off, and the seasoning and all that, that's very modern. Flavors, lots of fresh herbs, spices, fruit juices.
Yeah, your fruit sauces are particularly remarkable for a creative range of flavor combinations.
Well, and fruit sauces are great because fruit, when it's at its peak, it's just so full of flavor and willing to with you and be part of a dessert or a salad. So the fruit sauces was a lot of fun.
And, of course, your caramel sauces picks up on very trend-forward salted caramel sauce and that sort of thing. And
well, the thing that I find interesting about salted caramel is, especially when you learn to make caramel in France, it's always salted. You always put a little bit of salt in your sweet dishes because it just kind of, like for me, it's all about how do you develop just a tiny bit of tension in the flavors? That's what makes it more interesting and more, you know, you want to go back for a second bite. So there's always a little bit of salt in caramel, but now I think we all have an appetite. We've realized how fabulous it is to have a lot of salt in caramel. So we're up in that salt.
Well, you've done a remarkable job of organizing a range of sauces with this book, and I hope you do well with it. And I think that going to be, I think, a required book on the bookshelf in everybody's kitchen is what I think.
Oh, I love that sentiment. I'm glad you feel that way. And
yeah, you hope so, right? You certainly
yes,
hope so.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do, but I think beyond the fact that I'd love to sell some books, I think there is a lot of useful information for people in there. People who, you know, maybe are just looking for a little bump to move their cooking to the next level or to expand their repertoire or to get them excited about cooking again. Because if you integrate a few of these sauces into your daily cooking, all of a sudden it opens up a whole new world, and you feel great about yourself. Conquered a new little technique, and you know you've got a new secret weapon. That caramel sauce is my secret weapon for drop-in people for dinner or quick, you know, I've got to do something quick. Vanilla ice cream and a homemade caramel sauce is not a lot of effort, but the payoff is unbelievably great.
I want to pay tribute to you, especially for the thing Anne mentioned just briefly at the beginning of this interview, and that is your instructions on how to get organized before you
Good.
Begin.
And I wanted to put like big arrows in the book to direct people to that section because it's so important. If you want your cooking to get better, you can do two things. One is sharpen your knives. And two is do mise en place properly because it just gives you the freedom to then pay attention to the important things like how the cooking's going and how the seasoning's going. If you're encumbered by looking for the right bowl or you don't have something done in time, forget it. Not fun.
Sounds just like me.
Well, the thing that's funny is that in the rest of my life, I'm very disorganized and messy. See my house right now, you'd realize the mise en place was not in place. But when it comes to the kitchen, that's naturally, it's the way I cook, and it's a great skill to have.
Well, I think your sharing it is wonderful, and this is a fine piece of work, and I'm sure you're proud of it.
Well, I am. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon when you do
your next book.
All right.
Mud and something else.
Right. I look forward to that.
And we'll be back with some more fundamentals right after this short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our next guest is probably one of the most trusted cookbook writers anytime, any place, because she really is a born teacher, and she cares that you actually learn and also that you're inspired. Her latest book is geared to just that kind of thing and is called Cooking Confidence. Well, I must say that I'm totally exhausted just from reading the introduction. Joanne Weir, I don't know where you get the energy, but you ought to bottle that. Here you are. This is your, 17th book?
Correct.
Well, I didn't know how anybody could pull off 17 books and always have something new, but this one is. It's new and different. But to go over some of your other activities, first of all, you're a cooking star on PBS. You teach cooking as well. You just started a winery, or put your own label on a winery. What else did you just do?
I just opened a restaurant.
Called Copita in South
Korea.
And you did an app, an iPad app.
That was all this year.
Yeah, this is just this year. You premiered your new cooking show, Joanne Weir's Cooking Confidence, and started an online retail store, The Open Sky. I'd be interested to know how that's working out.
How do you have time to do laundry, Joanne?
I know. Well, yeah, I do a lot.
She comes back from all of this in a day and does dinner.
Dinner made simple.
Dinner made simple.
Well, that's the concept.
And dinner with confidence too, right?
Correct. What I found with people, I went around and I really asked people, what is it? Why do you not cook? Because a lot of people say, oh, I don't cook. And I was like, why don't you cook? And I thought they would say, oh, I don't have skills. I don't have ingredients. No, they all said the same thing. I lack confidence. And I thought, I'm going to write a book about cooking confidence and teach people how to cook, because my feeling is if you teach them one thing, like how to rib an egg yolk, who would ever know what ribboning is? It sounds like something you tie a gift with. Or who knows how to whip egg whites? Or what does scalding mean? If I could teach people that and they learn one little trick in the kitchen, that will give them confidence to go on and try another one.
And not only that, but they'll also probably buy your next book when it comes out.
Yeah, maybe. But I love this book. It's really Cooking Confidence, Dinner Made Simple, because let's face it, people don't say, what am I going to make for breakfast, or what am I going to make for lunch? I think really everyone has the dinner dilemma. Like we were talking, what are you going to make tonight for dinner? And so I wanted to do a book that the recipes are simple enough that you can do for your family on Tuesday night, but on Saturday night you can wow your guests with the same exact dishes by just adding a little first course or dessert. And I really feel like this book is what you need to seriously make dinner. And I'm so excited that everybody's so excited about it, because I am.
Well, you sound like you're excited about it. You sound really happy with what all you're doing. And you could have probably just published your intro to this and accomplish the same thing, because becoming a smart shopper is brilliant. You know, your tips on that are wonderful. Keeping a stocked, flexible pantry, again, a winner. You just touch all the bases, and
right.
I think it's great. And then on top of it all, your recipes are wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I really love the recipes in this book. Sometimes, I was thinking about this book, and I was like, really, what else do I have to say? And I'm really a teacher, and it's so important for me to get people back in the kitchen. You know, that's what my TV show is about, too, is really teaching people how to cook and having them feel like, yes, they can do it. And I think this book is a yes, you can do it all. You know, make food approachable, not something that's a mystery and people are afraid to do.
Oh, yeah. I'm surprised people have been shelling out all that loot for what's it called, modernist cooking at home,
right?
Whatever it's called.
Molecular gastronomy.
Yeah, but who would ever buy a book that I mean, the first one, all the chefs wanted to buy, but cooking
right
at home? I mean, please, give me a break.
I know, I don't get that either. And I was eating at a restaurant the other night in New York, and it was a delicious restaurant, it really was. But then they came out with something that was like this puffed walnut. It tasted like walnut, but it was like granular, and it just melted in your mouth. And I thought, what happened to just walnuts? I like walnuts. I want the texture.
Well, some of these are just so straightforward, tasty. I wonder why people just
don't think of it themselves. How do they need your direction? I guess they do.
Well, I thought of fun things like I gave my mother's meatloaf because it's so out of this world, and then things like the grilled steak and potato salad, which everybody loves steak and potatoes. Let's put it together and make it into a salad, and dishes that were really fun, like I really love the Lambert. Well, I teach a lot in the Mediterranean, so I teach in France. You didn't add that to my repertoire.
Oh, I didn't know you did that. You teach?
Yeah, I do. I just came back. So I just came back from teaching in the Mediterranean.
And where did you teach? Where do you teach when you go?
I was teaching this year. Every year it's different. I teach, the locations I use are in Morocco, in Spain, in Provence, and all over Italy. And this year I taught in Provence, Tuscany, and the Piedmont, which was great. It was truffle time, and we were buying truffles and cooking with the students, and it was really, really fun. But I just came back from Morocco, too, last year. And
that's the hottest cuisine, is Moroccan cuisine.
Oh, I love it. I love
the
food.
I do, too. I do, too. How was it traveling there? Because I really...
Oh, it's easy, and it was fun. My classes, I'm doing them again in 2013. What I do is I rent villas, and students from the United States come and study with me there.
Oh, wow. Oh, okay.
They're really fun. So anyway, I was teaching some Moroccan cooks kind of the food that I do too, which was great. But anyway, I came back with this recipe. They make this sausage and it's called merguez sausage. So what I did was I took, instead of making sausage and putting it in casings and spending all that time, I just took ground lamb, added all the same spices, and just made it into a merguez lamb burger. I did a little yogurt sauce with cucumbers and mint to go on the top. It is the most delicious thing. And that seriously takes 10 minutes to make. That's my idea of cooking. Keep it simple.
Well, and this excursion into the Mediterranean certainly explains some of these wonderful recipes. Like, my eye went immediately to couscous salad with smoked chicken, dates, and roasted pistachios.
That is delicious.
Oh, it looks fabulous.
There is another one in there it's a little bit of Moroccan inspired too. There's a few because I've been excited about Morocco, but really easy. This one is a chicken and sweet potato salad with cilantro and cumin. Oh, it's so delicious.
That's
from the
fabulous
book. Oh.
And they sound healthy, these recipes.
Yeah, I think that's really true about my food. Grew up with a mother who was also a professional chef, and my mother, her whole life, even though she was 5'7 and weighed 130 pounds, always wanted to lose 5 pounds. So I think I have the same philosophy. I've always got to lose 5 pounds.
Yeah, I do too.
So my stuff is healthy. I've always loved, I could drink olive oil. I mean, I love olive oil and all fresh vegetables. That's my thing.
Of course, have your own wine label, but you give a wine pairing for each of these. And you make it so simple. And then you add what you can do for dessert when you want to dress it up for the weekend.
Yes. What I do is really like, what could you, so these are, because these are the main courses, I tell you what simple, really simple thing you could do for a first course and what you could serve for a dessert. And those dishes are very, very quick. I mean, it could be something so quick as lemon sorbet drizzled with limoncello or something that's really easy. And seriously, so the dinner's going to take you, even for company, at the most, an hour. So that's really my idea for this book. And I feel like, let's face it, people just don't have the time to cook.
Right, they don't. And this is going along to get people excited about wanting to cook, too. What are some of your other favorite recipes in this book?
Well, there's another one that's in the book that when I got out of cooking school, I studied in France and got a Master Chef diploma. And when I got back to the United States, I was making all this fancy food, and because I studied with Madeline Kamen, and it was really, really wonderful working with her. So we would make like grilled ribeye steaks that we'd cut on the diagonal and fan them on the plate. We'd make butter with caramelized onions, gorgonzola, and you know, we'd spend days making an essence to go with it, this really elaborate sauce that they do in a 3-star restaurant. Well, my idea now is to do a burger, a really wonderful grass-fed burger with caramelized onions on the top and crumbled gorgonzola. And it's so simple and so delicious, and it just came to mind right away. But there's so many delicious ones I love. There's one that I did that has been a favorite with a lot of people, and it's the chicken breasts that are stuffed with goat cheese, arugula, and lemon.
Yes. I mean, they're classic combinations.
Yeah, delicious. And the other one that's really fun during the holiday season is I've been doing lemon turkey cutlets.
Yes,
and those are
too
fun, because I take the turkey breast and I just slice it on the diagonal, pound it. Everybody knows how to make chicken cutlets. Then I just put them in a little bit of flour, egg, and then breadcrumbs that have some cheese in them, just some grated Parmigiano Reggiano and some spices, and fry them and just serve them with lemon. They're so delicious. With a salad, that's dinner. You're done.
Yeah, well, I think that if people take your advice on how to stock their pantry, that's going to be half the battle, because, I mean, people don't usually have harissa prepared in the
right.
pantry and so forth.
And then even you can put things in the freezer, like have some chicken breasts in the freezer or ground beef in the freezer or some bread to make your breadcrumbs. And I always tell people, buy a few different mustards, like a grainy one and a Dijon mustard, and have good extra virgin olive oil and red wine vinegar, white wine vinegar, balsamic. It's in lots of spices. If you're really stocked in the pantry, have some pasta. You can make dinner with what you have in the refrigerator most times, or maybe you might have to go out to get a vegetable, or you might have to go out and get meat for that night, but you don't have to do the big shop each time. I like to just stock the pantry.
I think that's a good idea. I like to do that too.
Yeah.
Now that you've done all of this, of course, you're doing your book tour, which is going to take up some time. What possibly could you do next?
Oh, I know. It's a really good question. You know, it's funny. I wrote my 16th cookbook, which was a book about tequila. I'd always written about the Mediterranean, and then suddenly I write a book about tequila. And a very good friend who is a very well-known restaurateur, his name's Larry Mandel, and he's opened a lot of restaurants, a lot, and a lot of very successful restaurants, tasted my margarita from the book and said, Joanne, it's the best margarita I've ever had.
Really?
And I love it. It's my favorite drink in the world. He said, would you ever open a Mexican restaurant with me? And that was on my bucket list. And seriously, I've now, restaurateur, I've added it to my repertoire and my bio, and I don't know what's next. I think maybe opening a second restaurant with Larry. It's been really an amazing experience. We're doing really, really well. It's called Copita, and it's in Sausalito, which is that wonderful town that's right in, you know, across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco. And it's been really, really a fun project, and we are very, very busy. That's
so
great.
You're partnering with somebody on that restaurant.
Yes, with Larry Mandel.
Larry.
Yes.
And you say it's Mexican?
It is Mexican, but it's very fresh, and we make our own tortillas and our carnitas. We make every single thing. So, and it's very, very fresh and seasonal. So it's not like you're getting rice, beans, and heavy dishes with lots of cheese. It's very light. People are like, oh, I never liked Mexican food till I came to your restaurant. So it's a real compliment.
Of course, let's not mention that a margarita is about 1,200 calories.
Yeah, really. They're not so bad, actually, if you use ours are very simple. It's just with 100% agave tequila, agave nectar, which is lower glycemic index, and also lime juice. And they're delicious.
Well, yeah, I always liked them. I didn't want to hit 1,200 calories on a drink.
Right. Yeah. No, it's not. It's maybe about 120.
Oh,
even
no.
My mother will have one, and she's still on her diet.
She's still on her diet.
Well, you have to avoid the triple sec.
I don't put triple sec in them. Actually, it's just 2 ounces of 100% agave tequila, 1 ounce of lime juice, 3/4 ounce of agave nectar, and 3/4 ounce of water. And honestly,
water.
We shake them up. Yes.
I'll be darned.
And honestly, people say we have the best margarita in the Bay Area. So that's in all of San Francisco.
Well, you have a lot of places to try in San Francisco.
Right.
Do you go out for dinner ever?
Yeah, I do go out for dinner. I mean, I live in a great restaurant city, and we have such great ingredients, and spend a lot of time up in Napa and Sonoma now that I produce my wine. And, yeah, I do. I do go out, and I love to. That's really where I get inspiration.
Well, you're amazing. That's all I can
say. Oh, thank you.
And I hope you do amazingly well with this book. Again, it's Joanne Weir's Cooking Confidence, and most importantly, subtitled Dinner Made Simple. Well, good luck with you with this book and with all your other ventures.
Thank you so much. Thanks to both of you. And also, if you'd like to find out more, you can go to my website, joanneweir.com. It tells all about my classes and my wine, which is really, really... And I didn't even tell you about how I won 2 awards but for the wine so far. And it's our first
really?
2 wines out of the gate.
Tell me, what is
that? Oh, I'm so excited about it. We just launched our 2010 Chardonnay, and it was entered into the San Francisco International Wine Competition, and there were 454 entries. 20 got double golds, and I got a double gold. These were wines from Chardonnays from all over the world.
Good grief. That must
and be spectacular. It's a delicious Chardonnay. It's an online wine business, so you can find it on my website. And then my Cabernet just got 90 points in Wine Enthusiast. That's 100% Napa Cab, and it's delicious. It's so good.
Well, where did you learn winemaking?
I've always been interested in wine as much as food, and I've studied it since I was 24 years old. Okay. And I've just always really liked it. So I made it with wine, two winemakers. I made the white with Tom Foster, and I made the red with Michael Trujillo. It's really been a fun project.
Keep going, Joanne.
Thank you. I'm like the Energizer buddy.
You are. I mean, I'm already exhausted.
Really? I hope I don't run out of batteries.
I still think you should bottle that for your next project.
I love that idea.
Okay. Thanks, Joanne.
Great talking to you,
you too.
Really wonderful. Thank you.
So not only do you know how to make the right sauce to go with your celebratory meal, you'll also do it with a smile on your face and a feeling of ultimate confidence. And
freedom to make variations.
And hold up a minute, but don't go away, because there's more wonderful advice right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Now, you might be a little frightened by the reputation of our next guest, Nick.
Intimidated, I think is the word.
Okay. All right. Well, I can't pronounce his last name either, so go on. Correct me again. It's Maglieri?
Malgieri.
Malgieri. I always get it wrong. I get those vowels and consonants in the wrong order.
Yeah.
And not only that, but this is his 11th book. And I'm going to say this on air. I think it's his most approachable.
Yeah, we've
interviewed him several times, and he's such an authoritative person, but somehow he let his guard down and produced a book that is more suitable for the common man or woman in the kitchen. And
it's all concise and direct, and you'll find yourself turning out loaves.
Yeah, it actually tells you how to put them to good use as well.
Yes.
And that's what the 60 refers to. So Bake 60 has 60 recipes using Nick Malgieri's wonderful breads. So here we go, Nick.
Nick Malgieri, I guess you won't mind at this point in our relationship if I call you Mr. Bread.
Oh, no, not at all. You know what? After the couple thousand loaves that I've baked in the past year, I feel like Mr. Bread. Or just Bread, period.
Yes. Now, you are a director of the baking program at the Institute of Culinary Education in New York City. I mean, you've been out there for so long with your books. I mean, I think of you as a teacher, but also that you teach through the printed word. And this has gone now the 10th or the 11th?
11th
cookbook.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, you have suggestions online at nickmalgieri.com. You have articles and recipes appearing in all the major newspapers. After a while, what new can be said about bread? Because all your books seem to be fairly complete. You dealt with this one with a twist. Not only do you give what we've come to expect as straightforward instructions on making the best bread you can, but then you push it a little further and tell us how to use the breads and recipes.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed doing that part of it, although I enjoyed developing the bread recipes. When we were talking a minute ago, I told you that it's really important to have a range of different degrees of challenge in the recipes. So some of the recipes are very simple and straightforward, pretty much flour, water, yeast, and salt, just combined together. And, of course, the variations there are adding different flavorings to the doughs, or sometimes using whole wheat flour or a combination of white and whole wheat flour. But then there are other breads. There's slow-rise bread, which is a lot of fun. It uses very little yeast, and basically it's a very soft dough where you just stir everything together, cover it up, and leave it overnight, and then the next day you're ready to bake your bread. Then, if you're really interested in doing a bread baking project,
yes,
you can create your own sourdough starter out of either organic dark rye or whole wheat flour, and bring water and a pinch of additive salt and a little tiny bit of honey or barley malt syrup. And you've got a beautiful bubbling sourdough in about 36 hours.
Yeah, you have
so many different flours to work with and more available today. I'm talking you meaning bakers, you know, home
definitely
bakers.
Definitely easy to order flour online. But one of my favorite things to do, and I've discovered some really spectacular flours by doing so, is by visiting my local health food store. And I found a beautiful, locally made, entire whole wheat flour, which means that the flour is ground from the whole wheat berries.
Is that unusual?
So, you know, most industrially milled whole wheat flour is made like brown sugar. They take the white version and they add some of the brown stuff back to it. So, like with sugar, it would be adding molasses back into refined sugar to make brown sugar. And with whole wheat bread, what they, you know, each miller will do is they'll take white flour and they'll add back some of the bran and germ that was removed during the initial phases of milling. But this whole wheat flour is made entirely from the natural whole wheat berries, and it's organic. And I can't tell you what an excellent sweet taste it imparts to the bread without having any sugar in it at all.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it is. And your listeners should look for that, because health food stores can be a wonderful source for those locally milled or not too distant locally milled flours.
Someone we were interviewing suggested that we should all be milling our own flours. That seems a bit extreme.
I think so. Somebody passed me a little book that was written by somebody who has a big house in suburban Connecticut who decided that they were going to start even earlier than that and grow their own wheat and mill it. And I said to myself, well, this is kind of like a school science project, but it's not really about bread making.
Yeah. Do you know Frika, the green, burnt green wheat?
That comes from Puglia.
From where?
From Apulia, nearby, where Bari is in Italy, on the east coast of Italy, on the Adriatic side.
No, it's in origin Middle Eastern, but someone in Australia figured out how to grow it and do this process and started shipping it to the United States.
But they don't make bread out of it.
That was my question. I was wondering if you could make bread out of it. It's the best tasting stuff I've ever had.
Really? So what's burnt about it, though?
It's toasted green wheat.
Toasted green wheat.
Oh, it's toasted.
Yeah, it was discovered by accident. Yes. Some historical
interesting
thing.
Now, in Puglia, there's a tradition of making several kinds of handmade pasta out of durum flour that's been baked until it turns black.
Really?
Oh, wow.
And it derives from the fact that in former times, landlords got a quota of grain from their tenant farmers, and then in order to spite the farmers and not allow them to pick any of the wheat over and above the quota that they turned over to the landlord, they would burn the field.
Oh, how mean.
And the farmers would go and harvest that burnt wheat. So, yeah. But I don't know about that for bread making, but I'm going to look into that. That sounds fascinating.
Freekah, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that. There may not be an A at the end. It might be just KH at the end. I'm not sure.
KH. I don't know. But anyhow, these photos of you kneading the bread and...
It's EH. I'm Googling it right now.
Okay.
There we go. Good.
But this...
Just in case you get bored with the interview, you could do a little online on the side.
The photographs of you doing this kneading, the photograph of the texture is so perfect that it makes me nostalgic, and I want to feel that kneading of this dough. And
I was thrilled with the way the photographs turned out, mainly because we put together a wonderful team. The photographs were taken by Romulo Yanez, who was the head photographer for the Old Gourmet magazine for 20, 25 years, and also my old friend Paul Grimes. We worked together at Peter Kump's for many years, did the food styling for all of the dishes that were made from bread, as well as all the presentations for the breads that I made. I made all of the breads that appear in the book, and the photography was fun, but it was grueling. It was 3 weeks of me getting up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning to start doughs to bring to the studio, or sometimes bake finished breads to bring to the studio.
Now, what, take us through a few examples of, if you would, of what is the main thing that makes this book different, which is that you make a particular kind of bread and then that leads you to a recipe.
Well, I categorized all the different kinds of breads that I wanted to make, first of all. So again, I told you about the one-step bread, slow-rise bread, and then that's followed by low breads that are baked in pans, like sandwich bread. And also, then we have breads that are made with a yeast-based starter, where you just mix flour and a very small amount of yeast and water the night before you intend to mix the dough. And what this imparts to the dough is a much superior flavor and texture from just making the straight dough where you mix the flour, water, yeast, and salt together. So, for example, the baguette recipe in the book is made like that. Then there are, I told you a little bit about the sourdough already, and then we have whole grain bread, which can have starters or not, or sometimes sourdough too. And then we have flatbreads, we have crisp breads, like Italian grissini or breadstick, and then we go off into, I couldn't resist going off into the sweets. So we have some breads that are enriched and sweetened, but are different from yeast-risen cakes like panettone or babka, for example. And then we also have some yeast-risen buns, like sticky buns and cinnamon buns and crumb buns and a few other little unusual ones, and then some desserts that are made with bread as an ingredient. So that's a whole chapter that only utilizes bread as an ingredient. There are no bread recipes in that chapter. So, for example, there's an apple charlotte that is lined with either a sliced brioche loaf or sliced sandwich bread that's been buttered with a cooked apple filling inside. There's a classic British summer pudding that's made with raspberries and a little bit of red currant jelly, and it's just that wonderful, slightly cooked raspberry filling, which of course then soaks into the sandwich bread lining and turns it a bright red. The other chapters all have savory dishes that are made from bread. So, of course, there are sandwiches of many different kinds, both plain and cooked sandwiches like a croque monsieur, or sandwich with a cooked filling like a burger or a crab cake. There are bread salads, bread soups. There are croutons that are used as adjuncts to salads and soups. There are a bunch of different things that just use slices of bread, like the Catalan pan of tomate, which is a slice of grilled bread that's rubbed with a little olive oil and then a very ripe tomato. Like a steak. So there are a lot of unusual variations of bread that are fun to try, and many of them very easy. And I didn't even touch on the breadcrumbs, turn into meatloaf, and a wonderful recipe of Mexican meatballs in a green sauce. And
you even hit the northern stuff that's so hot now, Danish smorgasbord.
Definitely, yes. Yeah, that was a lot of fun to do. I had a lot of time with my friends from Visit Denmark who said to me, absolutely not, never put salmon on rye bread.
Oh, really?
Which, of course, that would be my first impulse, but
again,
in Scandinavia, they do it differently.
But these are so pretty. They're all works of art. I'd love to be able to make a beautiful loaf of challah. It seems like, and this one, I love this, smoked salmon and goat cheese braid.
That's right, and I left that out. There's a whole chapter of filled breads, too.
Uh-huh.
Breads that have different kinds of fillings, although I have to say I cheated a little bit on that one because I tried a couple of different doughs, and finally I decided on a brioche dough that is very low in sugar. It has just a little bit in it to take the kind of salty, yeasty edge off it, but it works beautifully, and there are a bunch of different ones. There are also Italian calzone. There are no pizzas in this book because I had a big section on pizzas in the previous book that was called Bake.
Right. We interviewed you about that one. I remember that. So what's coming up new in bread? And it's just everybody's been touching on all these different possibilities for it. Now, is this with ice cream you have breadcrumbs?
Brown bread ice cream. It's an Irish specialty.
Is it really?
It's little dices of whole wheat bread that are toasted, and then they're tossed with caramelized sugar that has a little butter in it, and then baked again so that the sugar sticks, and then you have to kind of very quickly use two buttered forks to pull all the little pieces of bread apart from each other. And then once they're cooled, they can go into, there's a recipe for the ice cream part, but you could also fold them into a good quality brand of vanilla ice cream.
Oh, you're amazing. Do you dream about breads?
I know I dream about bread. I dream about cakes. I dream about cookies. There isn't any aspect of baking that I don't dream about.
Oh, wow.
Now, do you make yourself a sandwich for lunch every day?
No, not necessarily, but I do once in a while.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I bet you're pleased that they now have a category for in food and wine for the best pastry chefs, huh?
Isn't that wonderful? Yeah.
Yeah.
The whole idea of pastry chefs coming into their own is something that's really happening these days.
Yeah,
and
well,
it's
finally, you know, they've already welcomed mixologists or whatever you call it, bartenders.
Sure.
So why not pastry
chefs? Well,
that's
a definite profession.
Well, there's so many good pastry chefs out there, and I'm glad we're finally getting around to recognizing that.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, and they've even, didn't they add a category in, no, they just nominated Christina Tosi, I guess it was, for a Beard Award last year. She's a pastry person. Anyhow, well, this is another winner, Nick.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And you're always so good to interview because you always you've thought everything through in advance, and so that's great.
And I'm anticipating a new book coming out in about 2 years.
Actually, less than 2 years. It's going to be a book about all pastry, but only ones made from dough. So there are going to be many, many pies and tarts, both large and individual, puff pastry. I went back. This past summer, I was in Vienna for a week, and I researched the actual ancestor of what we now call Danish pastry.
Really?
Which is still very much alive and well in Austria. And it's a little bit easier to make, and it makes some really exquisite both sweet and savory pastries.
Well, my guess is the title for that book would be A Baker's Dozen.
You never know.
or will that be the 13th book? I don't know.
That's true.
13th.
Hey, Nick, okay. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Nick, always fun.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure.
What can you say after that? Way to go, Nick, I guess. That's about all you can say, and so it's time for us to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here's more good advice and a lot of inspiration in Canal House Cooks Every Day. We've got Melissa Hamilton and Christopher Hersheimer. Now, Christopher was in some place exotic and actually wasn't on the interview, but Melissa Hamilton will describe you, and the book will reveal to you a lifestyle centered around the simple pleasures of cooking simple everyday meals and the friendship that has been formed over this is a very wonderful book. My first question is a little bit unorthodox, I suppose. How do you handle the fact that everybody's in love with you? And we're talking to Melissa Hamilton and Christopher Hersheimer. And honestly, I've never seen such raving tributes as you have on this current book that we're going to be talking about, Canal House Cooking Every Day. But everyone loves you.
That feels great. Thank you. What a great way to start off.
Well, aren't you impressed by that?
We're thrilled.
And then the other thing is that reading this, I'm so envious because you seem to have the most perfect, idyllic lifestyle in your little canal place. Explain what Canal House is, Darla.
Well, Canal House, this is Melissa. Canal House is a red brick
warehouse building that sits along a beautiful canal with a towpath just below. We're situated in Lambertville, New Jersey, which is right along the Delaware River with Pennsylvania, Bucks County, Pennsylvania, just across the way. We have our studio is upstairs in this building, and there's a bank of windows with natural light coming through, and it's our cooking studio and photography and design and writing studio.
Yeah, so many overlapping talents and different talents that it's just amazing. The photography, of course, is just glorious in this new book of yours, and the illustrations as well. You paint, you write, you cook. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. How long has this been going on?
A long time. We've worked with each other. You know, we probably have known each other 20 years, and we worked with each other.
At Sever, huh?
Yes, at Sever. And then both of us lived out here. I live in Bucks County, and Melissa lives in Hunterdon County, you know, just across the river.
Right.
And so we've worked together for so long, and we spent so much time together. Now we've been here in our studio about 5 years, and we just get along so well, and it's very fun. We're in the kitchen cooking together, and even the simplest thing, we'll say, should it be like this, or should it go a little more? Should I? All that lovely kitchen talk.
Now, who gets to cross the river?
I cross the river, Christopher.
So you're like Washington. You cross the Delaware regularly.
That's right. And, you know, we're not far from where Washington crossed. We're just about 15 minutes up the Delaware River from where Washington crossed.
Wow.
And we have to say that we're actually building where our studio is. The canal runs right next to us. And, in fact, the towpath for the canal is right under our windows, and we hear people walking up and down, and we see people in the canal, fishing in the canal, kayaking in the canal, or we just watch the ducks swimming in the canal, and thus the name Canal House.
Yes, and you have almost like a diary in this cookbook, not just seasonally, although it was organized seasonally, but also month by month.
Yeah.
You have, I would consider them essays about the time of the year, what you're doing, then the recipes about each recipe. It's very personal, isn't it?
It really is. We're here, and it's all real. This is what we're cooking every day, really. We're not making it up. When we started our studio, we said we would, every day we were going to cook lunch, and sometimes we might bring it from home, or someone will find something in the market in the morning. But we do. We eat lunch every day, and sometimes it's more elaborate, and sometimes it's simple. Sometimes it goes home with us as dinner. But this is what we do. We say basic, really, primarily, we're cooks. And what we want is for everybody to cook at home. It's such a pleasure.
You don't actually sell anything, do you?
No, we don't sell. We sell our book, but we're not a restaurant, and we're not a cooking school. And once a year, we open the studio to and have an open house where we cook for whoever comes.
Like, who does come, and how many people?
Well, we just did our, and how many people do you think we had, Christopher?
Did we have 200 people?
I was going to say maybe over 200 people. But the studio isn't that large. And there's this area, this beautiful Bucks County, Hunterdon County area. Is so many artists and studios and what have you. I don't think there are any cooking studios, though. So the reason why it's not that it's idyllic in that it's there's always a sunshine. It's not Shangri-La, but, you know, we've given up the big city jobs, and our commute now is very sustainable, and our lifestyle is very sustainable now, being able to work so closely to home, each of our homes, and that we're doing work that we love.
Yeah.
You know, that we have this opportunity to be cooking all the time and to be writing about it. And
you have a blog as well?
We have a blog.
A different
Cooks Lunch.
Okay, and you have a different, a separate cooking series of books that are seasonal, but I think you put it out every 3 months?
Yeah, every 4 months, three times a year.
Okay. What is your, that be separate from your blog? I mean, do you have a website that tells all this information?
Yeah, thecanalhouse.com is our website. And you know, we're just always cooking. That's where our recipes come from. And basically, we're just reacting to things. And today, I wish you could smell what's going on here, because today we're cooking, we're making soup. And so onions, or big pots of onions, are simmering on the stove, and all these beautiful Hubbard and kombucha and cheese pumpkins are roasting in the oven.
Oh, wow.
And the smell is pretty fantastic. And then Melissa found some gorgeous, those little tiny, tiny Brussels sprouts. And so that's sort of what happens for us. We react to what we see. She saw those little Brussels sprouts in the market today, and she walked in and said, we're having a vegetarian plate for lunch. Uh-huh. And so we'll have roasted squash and some cauliflower and little tiny Brussels sprouts. And so anyone who cooks knows you just get turned on when you see something terrific in the market.
Now, isn't it funny? I had Brussels sprouts for lunch, but they were leftover.
That's okay.
And I ate them with two leftover hot dogs.
Oh, that sounds kind of good, that pork and Brussels sprout thing going.
I'm not sure they were pork hot. I think they were mystery meat hot dogs.
Yeah, I think they were too. Most of the recipes are kind of accessible to many different levels, including a beginning cook, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they're basically simple, although you get a little bit more elaborate. You do have a seasonal feast section, celebration menus, you call it.
Yes. But no, everyone faces Christmas and Thanksgiving, and there are some celebrations that you sort of, or even as simple as St. Patrick. I mean, isn't that great? You're really, we always fix a big corned beef and cabbage lunch. So it feels like we don't want that to be lost. We want people to know how to do that at home.
Now, I was interested that you, Jim Lay's No Need Bread.
Oh, well, that's one of the great recipes, right?
Yeah, we've been made that a couple before? Times. Mm. I've never made it, but no, I've been tempted.
Mm. Oh, it's so great. And we did our own, everyone tweaks everything themselves, you know how it is. So this is, but we give him full credit. He's a master and a magician.
Oh, and he explains everything so well. As I said, we've interviewed him, and he's really, he's very, very articulate.
Yes.
You forage, too. I mean, you have a whole section on chanterelle mushrooms.
Yeah. We can't help ourselves, This year, 1 year, oh my gosh, 1 year, it was a wet summer, and we kind of hate those summers because it can get so humid, but the silver lining, of course, is that the woods are full of the mushrooms, so together, or one of us will just dive into the dark woods, July, end of July through September, poke around in there and see what's popping up, and one time we came upon, it was practically a it was like a field in the dark woods that were just glowing with chanterelle. So it was very, it was more like harvesting. It wasn't like foraging because it was so easy to load up the shopping bags of mushrooms that day.
And then we had people for dinner that night. So what we did is we have a couple who are so local and fabulous, and they raise beautiful chickens. The name of their business is Purely, and they raise sheep and pigs and chickens and turkeys.
And rabbits.
And we bought this beautiful chicken. It was the Marilyn Monroe of chickens with creamy skin and big breasts and, oh my God. And so we just roasted this gorgeous thing, and we had this wonderful California contingency out here. We were shooting one of Alice Waters' books, and we were so proud because you know how beautiful the things are in Northern California. But we had this gorgeous local chicken, and then we just smothered it in foraged golden chanterelles, and we just had bread, and everybody ate it, popped it all up. It was the best. It was local. It was delicious.
And the recipes in the book, the only problem is that the supply of chanterelles is not in the book.
well, we'll send you a picture.
Series.
Yeah, it's in our little series, yeah.
Okay. Now, it's interesting. The mushroom fairy just landed here yesterday.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Because, we have all those mushrooms.
We got 2 pounds plus of different kinds of mushrooms, which we're supposed to use in the next 8 days. So we're thinking creative things to do with mushrooms right now. In fact, I have a dish that I've conceived for Sunday, but I can't tell Anne what it is on the air, because otherwise the secret will be out and everybody will want to make it.
but that's okay. It sounds good. Whisper it to us later.
Well, I'll give you a clue. Three of the ingredients are beef and parsnips.
Ooh.
And mushrooms.
Ooh. And that sounds pretty earthy.
And there'll be a few other things in there too, including some dark beer.
Mm.
But I haven't given away the entire recipe.
No, we want to know.
Well, I'll sip it to you on the side.
Thank you.
You have some favorite recipes in this book, I'm sure. I liked your goose with the 10 legs.
You see, we have a sense of humor, right?
Yes. Well, yeah. Well, we've had geese from those Schlitz, are they?
Schultz.
Yeah.
Schultz.
They're great.
Yeah. Have you ever tried their smoked one?
Yes, actually, yeah. Years ago.
Yeah, it's interesting.
But well, the thing is that, you know, the problem with the goose is the reality is you really want the legs, because the breast is a little bit dry, and we'd rather make a stock. So we say just buy the whole goose for presentation, and then they allow you to just buy the legs, which are just delicious. And then everybody gets legs, and you have a presentation piece for the ta-da factor when you come to the table, and then just make stock.
Uh-huh. So but what are the stars of this cookbook? Which are your big hit recipe?
It's just like everything. It's a little bit whatever you're in the season of. And that's what you, I mean, that is not to be serious about it. Right now, we'll kick the salad out of the way, because what we want is something braised right now. We've been eating delicious salads all summer long, and now is the time. And great thing about December coming up, we are influenced always by other cultures, and Italy really goes to town in the holidays with pasta. So we love to make pasta, and we'll be making lasagna, because this is a time of year that you don't mind spending some time preparing things, because it's a holiday. So we'll be making lasagnas and cannelloni, and we love those recipes. We really love, we feel them.
Yeah, so you are into making your own pasta.
Yeah.
And your own pizzas. I thought that was very impressive, your pizzetta series here.
Well, it's not hard, and we sort of believe in the zen of the process. That's what's so wonderful, is to lose yourself in cooking. We all have all our financial problems, love problems, health problems, but you can lose yourself in sort of the meditation of cooking.
Well, I must say that you seem like a match set here, because I mean, the photographs of you on the news release, you look like your sisters. It's not twins.
Well, you know, when you spend a lot of time with someone, maybe you start to look. We thank goodness we don't. Well, I don't know. We have a studio dog. Henry, the studio dog, and it's really Christopher's beloved, but she does not look like Henry yet. So maybe what's happened is we have started to look like each other,
but fortunately not like the dog. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, the two of you, I wish you continued success in all of your ventures, and also particularly good success with this book, which I think that everybody should rush out and get for holiday prep. So again, it's Canal House Cooks Every Day, and it's by Hamilton and
Hirschheimer. Yeah.
Hirschheimer, and that's Christopher and Melissa, in reverse for the order in which I said the names.
We thank you both so much for having us on the menu. We really appreciate it. We love your show, and so it's a great honor for us to be on it.
Okay, listeners, now weren't you surprised to find out that Christopher was a girl?
I keep forgetting every time I read the name.
And these two wonderfully level-headed ladies who seem to have such a wonderful time every day.
And the photographs in this book will make you envious.
Shows you what a wonderful time they have every day.
Oh, they do.
So you can do the same thing. Don't forget, make lunch every day. And that's all for this week's program. And we wish you again. We wish you happy birthday. Happy birthday, Adam. Happy holidays to all of you who are not lucky enough to have a birthday today. And we'll talk to you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.